and then at the dead Honda's load space, where their suitcase was weighing down the springs. "I don't know," he said. "Maybe we could tow the car with a quad bike. Maybe the keys are in them, or on a hook inside the barn."
"We can't steal a quad bike. It wouldn't be stealing. It would be borrowing. We could tow the car 2 miles to the road, and then bring the quad bike back again. Then what? All we would have is a dead car on the side of the road. Maybe a wrecker would come by.
Or we could get any kind of ride and forget about the car. The county would come along and junk it sooner or later.
Do we have a tow rope? Maybe there's one in the barn.
I don't think a quad bike would be strong enough. We could use two, like tugboats pulling an ocean liner to the harbor mouth."
"That's crazy," Patty said.
"Okay, maybe we could use a quad bike to haul just the suitcase."
"You mean drag it along?"
"I think they have a platform on the back. Too small. Then we could balance it on the gas tank and the handlebar."
"They won't like it if we leave our car here."
"Too bad. Do you even know how to drive a quad bike? It can't be that hard. We would want to go slow anyway, and we couldn't fall off. Not like a regular motorbike."
"It's a possibility," Patty said. "I suppose."
"Let's wait until after dinner," Shorty said. "Maybe the phone is back on, and the mechanic will show up, and everything will work out fine. If not, we'll take a look at the barn after dark. Okay?" Patty didn't answer. They stayed where they were, slumped down in their lawn chairs, keeping the low sun on their faces. They left their room door wide open. 50 yards away in the command center in the back parlor, Mark asked, "Who missed the cotton bud?"
"All of us," Peter said. "We all checked the room and we all signed off on it."
"Then we all made a bad mistake. Now they're agitated. Way too soon. We need to pace this better."
"He thinks it was the painter. She'll believe him eventually. She doesn't want to worry. She wants to be happy. She'll talk herself around. They'll calm down."
"You think?"
"Why would we lie about the room? There's no possible reason for it."
Mark said, "Bring me a quad bike." Chapter 10 Reacher walked back to the fancy county office with the census scans and the million-dollar cubicles, and he found the same surly guy on duty at the desk. Once again, Reacher asked for 2 censuses, the first when Stan was 2, and the second when he was 12, but this time for the rest of the county that lay outside of Laconia's technical city limit. The guy said, "We can't do that."
"Why not?"
"You're asking for a donut shape, with a hole in the middle, which is Laconia, which you already saw. Am I right?"
"You got it in one."
"That's not how the extracts are done. There are no donut shapes. You can have an area, or a bigger area, or a bigger still area, which would be the city, the county, and the state. But the bigger area always includes the smaller area all over again, and the bigger still area includes both of them all over again. Which is logical if you think about it. There are no holes in the middle. The city is in the county, and the county is in the state."
"Understood," Reacher said. "Thank you for the explanation. I'll take the whole county."
"Are you still a resident?"
"You agreed I was this morning, and here I am again. Clearly, I didn't leave town with all my worldly possessions. I would say my status as a resident is more secure than ever."
"Cubicle 4, the guy said.
Patty and Shorty heard an engine start up in the distance, deafening like a motorcycle, and they got up and walked to the corner to take a look. They saw Peter riding a quad bike back to the house. Now, only 8 were neatly parked.
"First turn of the key," Shorty said.
"I hope they're all like that."
"Way too noisy," Patty said, disappointed. "We can't do it. They would know."
Peter parked at the distant house. He killed the engine, and silence came back. He got off and went inside. Patty and Shorty went back to their lawn chairs. Shorty said, "The land is pretty flat around here."
"Does that help us?" "We could push the quad bike, with the engine off, with the suitcase balanced on it.
We could use it like a furniture dolly.
Could we?
That can't be that heavy. You see people wheeling motorbikes all the time. We wouldn't even have to keep it upright, and there are two of us. I bet we could do it dead easy.
2 miles there and 2 miles back, which would leave the suitcase by the side of the road, and us back here. So then we would have another 2 miles to walk. Altogether 6, 4 of them pushing a quad bike. It would take a good long time.
I figure about 3 hours, Shorty said. Depends on how fast we could push. We don't know yet.
Okay, call it 4 hours.
We should time it to finish at dawn. Maybe we might see a farmer heading to market. There has to be traffic sometimes. So we should start in the middle of the night.
Which is good. They'll be asleep.
It's a possibility, Patty said. I suppose.
They heard the distant quad bike start up again, 50 yards away, then closer. It sounded like it was passing the barn and coming straight toward them. They stood up. The engine got loud, and the machine roared around the corner, with Mark riding it, scattering dirt. There was a cardboard carton strapped to the rack on the back. Mark braked to a stop and tapped the gear change into neutral and shut the motor down. He smiled his master of the universe smile.
Good news, he said. The phone is back on. The mechanic will be here first thing in the morning. We were too late to get him today, but he knows what the problem is. He's seen it before. Apparently there's an electronic chip close to where the heater hoses go through the back of the dashboard. The chip fries when the water in the hoses gets too hot. He's bringing a replacement chip he got from a wrecker's yard. He wants $5 for it, plus 50 for labor.
That's great, Shorty said.
Patty said nothing.
Mark said, and I'm afraid I want another 50 for the room.
There was silence for a second.
Mark said, guys, I would love to tell you just forget it, but the bank would kick my ass. This is a business, I'm afraid. We have to take it seriously. And from your point of view, it's not so terrible. 100 for the motel and 50-some to fix your car, and you're out of here for less than $200 all in. Could have been a whole lot worse.
Come take a look at this, Patty said.
Mark climbed off the quad bike, and Patty led the way inside the room. She pointed down into the void under the vanity.
Mark said, what am I looking for?
You'll see.
He looked. He saw. He said, oh dear. He bent down and came back up with the cotton bud.
I apologize most sincerely, he said. This is unforgivable.
Why did you tell us we were the first guests in this room?
What?
You made a big deal out of it.
You are the first guests in this room. Most definitely. This is something else entirely.
The painter? Shorty said.
No.
Then who? Patty asked.
The bank told us to improve our marketing. We hired a photographer to take pictures for a new brochure. He brought a model from Boston with him. We let her do her makeup in here because it's the nicest room. I suppose we were trying to impress her. She was very good looking. I thought we cleaned up after her. Obviously, we didn't succeed completely. Again, I apologize most sincerely.
So do I, Patty said, I guess,
for jumping to conclusions.
How did the pictures come out?
She was dressed as a hiker. Very big boots and very short shorts. A hiker on a warm day, clearly, because her top wasn't huge either. The motel was behind her. It looked pretty good. Patty gave him 50 of her hard-earned bucks. She said, what do we owe you for the meals?
Nothing, Mark said. That's the least we can do.
Are you sure?
Absolutely. That's just housekeeping money. The bank doesn't see those numbers. He put the 50 bucks and the cotton bud in his pants pocket. He said, and kind of on the same subject, I have something for you. He led the way out to the lot again, back to the quad bike, to the carton strapped to its rack. He said, you are absolutely invited to dinner tonight, of course, and breakfast tomorrow. But equally, all of us would absolutely understand if you preferred to eat alone, just the two of you. Everyone knows making conversation can be stressful.
We put together some ingredients for you. Either join us at the house or help yourselves from the box. No pressure either way. He undid the straps and hefted the box in his arms. He half-turned and slid it into Shorty's waiting hands. "Thank you," Patty said. Mark just smiled and climbed aboard the quad bike and started up its ferocious engine. He turned a wide circle in the stony lot and disappeared around the corner, heading back to the house. Cubicle 4 was the same as Cubicle 2, except in a different place. Otherwise, it was identical. It had the same tweed chair, and a flat screen, and a sharpened pencil, and a pad of paper with the county name at the top, like a hotel brand. The flat screen was already lit up blue, with two icons already top right, like stamps on a letter, the same as before. Reacher double-clicked on the first and saw the same battleship gray background and a title page in the same government writing, saying all the same things he had seen before, except for the center line, which said this time the returns were extracted for the county as a whole. He scrolled down, with the wheel between the mouse's shoulder blades. The same introduction was there, with the same long disquisition about improvements in methodology. He skipped it all and went straight to the list of names. He got a rhythm going, flicking at the wheel with the tip of his finger, using some kind of elastic inbuilt momentum, spooling through the A section, and the B section, and the C section, then speeding to a blur, and then letting the list settle and slow and come to a stop among a short run of Q names. There was a Quaid family, and a Quail, and a Quattlebaum, and two Queens. He rolled on to the R section. And there they were, near the top. James Reacher, male, white, 26 years old, a tin mill foreman, and his wife Elizabeth Reacher, female, white, 24 years old, a bedsheet finisher, and their thus far only child Stan Reacher, male, white, 2 years old. 2 years old in April, when the census was taken, which would make him 3 years old in the fall, which would make him 16 years old late on a September evening in 1943, not 15. The old bird-watching lady was right. Reacher said, "Huh." He read on. Their address was given as a number and a street in a place called Ryantown. Their home was rented, at a cost of $43 a month. They didn't own a radio set. They didn't work on a farm. James had been 22 and Elizabeth 20 when they married. Both could read and write. Neither had any Indian tribal affiliation. Reacher double-clicked on the tiny red traffic light at the top of the document, and the screen went back to the blue wash with the two postage stamps. He double-clicked on the second of them, and the census from 10 years later opened up. He scrolled down, swooping through most of the alphabet, once again rolling to a stop among the Q names. The Quades were still there, and the Quails, and the two Queen families. But the Quattlebaums had gone. The Reachers were still there. James, Elizabeth, and Stan, in that April 36, 34, and 12 years old, respectively. Apparently, there had been no further children. No siblings for Stan. James had changed his employment to laborer on a county road grading crew, and Elizabeth was out of work altogether. Their address was the same, but the rent had dropped to $36. 7 years of depression had taken its toll, on workers and landlords alike. James and Elizabeth were still listed as literate, and Stan was in daily attendance at school. The household had acquired a radio set. Reacher wrote the address with the sharpened pencil on the top sheet of the branded notepaper, which he then tore off and folded up and stuck in his back pants pocket. Mark parked the quad bike back at the barn and walked on down to the house. The phone rang as soon as he got in the door. He picked it up and said his name, and a voice told him, "There was a guy here, name of Reacher, checking out his family history. A big guy, pretty rough. He won't take no for an answer. So far he's looked at 4 different censuses. I think he's searching for an old address. Maybe he's a relative. I thought you should know." Mark hung up, without replying.
Chapter 11 Reacher walked back to the city office and got there a half hour before the close of business. He went up to the records department and pressed the bell. A minute later, Elizabeth Castle came in. "I found them," he said. "They lived beyond the city limit, which is why they didn't show up the first time around."
"So no federal warrants?"
"Turned out they were relatively law-abiding."
"Where did they live?"
"A place called Ryantown."
"I'm not sure where that is."
"Well, that's a shame, because I came here especially to ask you."
"I'm not sure I ever heard of it."
"Can't be far away, because his birdwatching club was here in town." She took out her phone and did things to it with spread fingers. She showed him. It was a map, expanded. She spread her fingers some more, and smaller places popped into view. Then she moved the magnified image around, circling Laconia's boundary, examining the nearby hinterland. No Ryantown.
"Try further out," he said.
"How far would a kid go for a birdwatching club?"
"Maybe he had a bike.
Maybe Ryantown was boring. The cops told me there were all kinds of little spots, each with a couple dozen families and not much else. Maybe it was a place like that."
"It would still have birds, surely.
Maybe more than here if it was quiet."
"The cops said there were all kinds of mills and little factories. Maybe the atmosphere was smoky."
"Okay, wait," she said. She started over with her phone. This time typing and tapping, not swooping around. Maybe a search engine, or a local history site.
"Yes," she said. "It was a tin mill. Belonged to a man named Ryan. He built worker accommodations and called the place Ryantown. The mill finally closed in the 1950s, and the town died, such as it was to begin with. Everyone left, and the name fell off the map."
"Where was it?"
"Supposedly north and west of here," she said. She dabbed the map back on her phone and spread and pinched and moved her fingers around. "About here, possibly," she said.
There was no name on the map, just a blank gray shape and a road.
"Zoom out," he said.
She did, and the gray shape receded to a pinprick, north and west of Laconia, maybe 8 miles out. Between 10 and 11 on a clock face, it was one of many similar pinpricks, like busy planets around a sun, held close in by gravity or magnetism or some other kind of strong attraction. Like Detective Brenda Amos had predicted, for all practical purposes, Ryantown had been part of Laconia, no matter what the Postal Service said. The road that passed it by went onward toward nowhere in particular. It just meandered north and west, 10 or more miles, and then another 10 through a wood, and then onward. A back road, like the one he had been on with the guy in the Subaru. He could picture it. He said, "I guess there won't be a bus."
"You could rent a car," she said. "There are places here in town."
"I don't have a driver's license."
"I don't think a cab would want to go out there."
8 miles, he thought.
"I'll walk," he said.
"But not now. It would be dark as soon as I got there.
Tomorrow, maybe."
"You want to get dinner tonight?"
"What?"
"Dinner," he said. "The third meal of the day. Generally eaten in the evening. Can be functional, or social, or sometimes both."
"Well, I can't," she said. "I'm having dinner with Carter Carrington tonight."
Shorty carried the cardboard carton into the room and placed it on the dresser in front of the TV screen. Then he sat with Patty, side by side in their lawn chairs, through the last of the afternoon sun. She didn't talk. She was thinking. She often was. He knew the signs. He guessed she was processing the information she had received, examining it, turning it this way and that, until she was satisfied. Which would be soon, he thought. Surely. He really didn't see much of a problem anymore. The thing with the cotton bud had a simple explanation. And the phone was back on. The mechanic was coming first thing in the morning. Total damage less than $200.
A drag for sure, but not a disaster. Patty said, "Let's not go to the house for dinner." I think he was kind of hinting they didn't want us to. He said we were invited. He was being polite. I think he meant it. But he was also looking at it from our point of view. Now he's your best friend forever?
I don't know, Shorty said. Most of the time I think he's a weird asshole who needs a smack. But I have to admit he did good with the mechanic. He explained the problem and got a solution. That shows he's taking it seriously. Maybe we were both right, way back at the beginning.
They're weird, but also they're doing their best for us.
I guess they could be both things at once.
Whichever, let's eat just the two of us.
Works for me. I'm sick of answering their questions. It's like the third degree.
I told you, Patty said. They're being polite. It's considered polite to take an interest.
They got up and stepped inside the room. They left the door wide open. They shifted the cardboard box to the bed. Patty slit the tape with her thumbnail. Shorty lifted the flaps. Inside was an assortment of items, densely and meticulously packed. There were cereal bars and power bars and energy bars, and bottles of water, and packets of dried apricots, and tiny red boxes of raisins. Everything was arranged in a specific pattern that repeated 12 times over. Like 12 identical meals, all neatly laid out. Each one had a bottle of water, and then an equal 1/12 share of the rest of the stuff.
There were also two flashlights in the box, standing on their ends, crammed in among the food.
Weird, Patty said. I think this place is for hikers, Shorty said. Like in the photograph they took with the model. Why else would they dress her up like that? I bet they give this stuff out as box lunches. Or sell it. It's the kind of thing a hiker likes to carry.
Is it?
It's compact and high energy. Easy to put in a pocket. Plus water.
What are the flashlights for?
I suppose in case you're out late and have to eat in the dark.
A lantern would be better.
Maybe hikers prefer flashlights. I'm sure there's consumer feedback. I think this is part of their stock of supplies.
He said ingredients.
It's probably a balanced diet. Probably quite healthy. I bet hikers worry about that kind of thing.
He said they put some ingredients together.
They didn't put this together.
It's prepackaged. Like you said, off their storeroom shelf.
We could still go eat at the house.
I told you, I don't want to.
They don't want us there.
Then we gotta eat this stuff.
Why does he make such grandiose statements? He could have said he brought the same iron rations he sells the hikers for lunch. I would have been happy with that. It's not like we're paying for it.
Exactly, Shorty said. They're weird. But kinda helpful, too.
Or the other way around.
Reacher ate dinner alone in Laconia, at a greasy hole in the wall with no tablecloths. He didn't want to risk a fancier place, in case Carter Carrington and Elizabeth Castle picked the same spot. They would feel obliged to at least come over and say hello. He didn't want to disturb their evening. Afterward, he spent an hour walking random blocks, looking for a grocery store with an apartment window above it that faced east down the length of a street. He found one plausible possibility. It was dead ahead as he walked away from the center of downtown. The apartment was now an attorney's office. The store now sold pants and sweaters. He stood with his back to its window. He looked down the street. He saw a good-sized patch of night sky in the east, and below it, the camber of the blacktop, humped between two gutters, flanked by two curbs and two sidewalks, lit up here and there by widely spaced street lamps. He walked the same direction the 20-year-old had walked. He stopped 30 yards out. Any closer than that, he felt the old lady wouldn't have used the binoculars. She would have trusted the naked eye. He turned around and looked up at her window. Now he was the smaller boy. He imagined the big guy in front of them, demanding, and then threatening. Technically no big deal. For Reacher himself, anyway. At 16, he had been bigger than most 20-year-olds. He had been bigger at 13. Biology had been good to him. He was fast and nasty. He knew all the tricks. He had invented some of them. He had grown up in the Marine Corps, not in Ryantown, New Hampshire. And Stan had been a normal-sized person by comparison. Compact, even, in some respects. Maybe 6'1 in dress shoes. Maybe 190 after a four-course dinner. Reacher looked down at the bricks in the sidewalk and imagined his father's footsteps there, inching backward, and then turning and running. Patty and Shorty ate outside, under their window in their lawn chairs. They took meal number one and meal number two, which left 10 in the box, and they dutifully drank their bottles of water. Then it got cold and they moved inside. But Patty said, "Leave the door open." Shorty said, "Why?" "I need the air. Last night I felt like I was choking." "Open the window." "It doesn't open." "The door might blow." "Wedge it with your shoe." "Someone might get in." "Like who?" Patty said. "A passerby." "Here? Or one of them?" "I would wake up. Then I would wake you up. Promise?" "Count on it." Shorty kicked off his shoes and wedged one between the outer face of the door and the jamb, and he bent the other into a pliable shape and propped it against the inner face to push back against gentle nighttime breezes. Potato farmer engineering, he knew, but it looked like it might work. Chapter 12. Stephen called to Robert, who called to Peter, who called to Mark. They were all in different rooms. They got together in the back parlor and stared at the screens. "It's a pair of shoes," Stephen said, "in case you're wondering." "Why did they do it?" Mark asked. "Did they say?" "She wants air. It's consistent behavior. She's mentioned it before. I don't think it's a problem." Mark nodded. "I told her a story about a supermodel doing her makeup. I think she believed it. I told her a mechanic will be riding to the rescue in the morning. I even made up some technical stuff about the heater hoses. I think she believed all of it. I think she's calm now. Doesn't matter about the door. We need to lock it pretty soon. But not tonight. Let sleeping dogs lie. They're relaxed now. They have nothing to worry about." Reacher preferred to move on whenever possible. So he found a new place to sleep, one street away from the previous night. It was a fancy bed and breakfast, in a narrow house built of brick, with its trim newly painted in faded colors. He got a top-floor room, through a low door at the head of a steep and dog-legged stair. He took a long hot shower and fell asleep, still warm and damp, until 1 minute past 3 in the morning. Once again he snapped awake instantly, like flicking a switch. The same thing, exactly. Not touch, or taste, or sight, or smell. Therefore sound. This time he got out of bed immediately, and he pulled his pants out from under the mattress and dressed fast and tied his shoes. Then he headed out through the low door and down the winding stair to the street. The night air was cool, and the silence was hard and brittle. All brick and glass and narrow spaces and humming electricity in the wires. He stood still. A minute later, he heard a brief scrape of feet on the sidewalk, ahead and half left, maybe 30 yards away. Not going anywhere, just shuffling in place. Maybe 2 people. Nothing visible. He waited. Another minute later, he heard a muted yelp, a woman's voice. Maybe joy. Or ecstasy. Or maybe not. Maybe outrage or anger. It was hard to tell. But it was definitely muted. It was suppressed in a particular way. It was the sound of clamped lips. Nothing visible. He moved left and saw a gap between a bag store and a shoe store. It was pedestrian access to a narrow alley that divided 2 buildings. The alley had doors both sides for walk-up apartments above the stores. Two people were standing next to one of the doors, a man and a woman, in a full-on clinch, like wrestling standing up. They were half lit by a harsh bulb above the door. The guy was young, not much more than a kid, but he was big and solid. The woman was a little older. She had blonde hair, and she was wearing high heels and black nylons under a short black coat, which was getting rucked up by the wrestling. Good or bad? Hard to tell. He didn't want to ruin anyone's evening. He watched. Then the woman squirmed her face away and said, "No," in a sudden low and breathy tone, like spitting, as firm as talking to a dog, but also with what Reacher took to be feelings of shame and embarrassment and disgust. She pushed against the guy's chest and tried to get away. The guy wouldn't let her. Reacher said, "Hey." They both turned their faces toward him. He said, "Take your hands off her, kid." The boy said, "This is none of your business." "It is now. You woke me up." "Get lost." "I heard her say no. So step back." The kid half turned. He was wearing a sweatshirt embroidered with the name of a famous university. He was a big, solid boy, maybe 6'3 and 220 pounds, maybe an athlete. He was rippling with youth and excitement. He had a look in his eye. He thought he was a hell of a guy. Reacher looked at the woman and said, "Miss, are you okay?" She asked, "Are you a cop?" "I was once upon a time in the army. Now I'm just a guy passing through." She didn't reply. She was close to 30, Reacher thought. She looked like a nice person, but sad. "Are you okay?" he asked her again. She pushed away from the boy and stood a yard apart. She didn't speak, but she looked at Reacher like she didn't want him to leave. He said, "Did this happen last night, too?" She nodded. "Same place?" She nodded again. "Same exact time?" "It's when I get home from work." "You live here?" "Until I get on my feet." Reacher looked at her heels and her hair and her nylons and said, "You work in a cocktail bar." "In Manchester." "And this guy followed you home?" She nodded. "Two nights running," Reacher said. She nodded again. The boy said, "She asked me to, man." "So butt out and let nature take its course." "That's not true," the woman said. "I did not ask you. You were all over me. I was being polite. That's what you do when you work in a cocktail bar." Reacher looked at the boy. "Sounds like a classic misunderstanding," he said, "but easily fixed. All you need to do is apologize most sincerely, and then go away and never come back." "It's her who won't come back. Not to that bar, anyway. My father owns a big chunk of it. She'll lose her job." Reacher looked at the woman and said, "What happened last night?" "I let him," she said. "He agreed one time only. So I got it over with. But now he's back for more." "I'll discuss it with him, if you like," Reacher said. "Meanwhile, you go inside now if you want. And think no more about it." "Don't you dare go inside," the boy said. "Not without me." The woman looked from him to Reacher and back again. And again, as if choosing. As if down to her last 20 bucks at the racetrack. She made her decision. She took her keys from her bag and unlocked her door and stepped inside and closed her door behind her. The boy in the sweatshirt stared first at the door and then at Reacher, who jerked his head toward the mouth of the alley and said, "Run along now, kid." The boy stared a minute longer, apparently thinking hard, and then he went. He walked out of the alley and turned out of sight. To the right, which made him right-handed. He would want to set up his ambush so that Reacher would walk face first into a free-swinging right hook, which pretty much defined the location. About 3 feet around the corner, Reacher thought, level with the edge of the bag shop's window, because of the pivot point for the right hook. Basic geometry, fixed in space. But not fixed in time. Speed was under Reacher's control. The kid would be expecting a normal kind of approach, plus or minus. Maybe a little tense and urgent. Maybe a little cautious and wary. But mostly average. He would trigger the hook at the first glimpse of Reacher coming around the corner. Any kind of normal walking pace would bring it home good and solid. The kid wasn't dumb. Possibly an athlete. Probably had decent hand-eye coordination. Therefore, nothing would be done at normal or average speed. Reacher stopped 6 paces short of the corner and waited and waited. And then he took another pace, a slow, sliding scrape across grit and dirt. And then he paused and waited and took another step, slow, sliding, ominous. And then another long wait and another slow step. He pictured the kid around the corner, tensed up, his fist cocked, holding his position. And holding. Holding too long. Getting too tensed. Getting all cramped and shaky. Reacher took another step, long and slow. Now he was 6 feet from the corner. He waited. And waited. Then he launched fast at a run, his left hand up, palm open, fingers spread like a baseball glove. He burst around the corner and saw the kid sputtering to life, confused by the change of pace, locked into slow motion waiting, so that his triumphant right hook was so far coming out like a herky-jerky feeble squib, which Reacher caught easily in his left palm, like a soft liner to second. The kid's fist was big, but Reacher's open hand was bigger. So he clamped down and squeezed, not hard enough to crush the bones, but hard enough to make the kid concentrate on keeping his mouth shut, so no whines or squeals came out, which obviously he couldn't afford, being a hell of a guy. Then Reacher squeezed harder, mostly as an IQ test, which the kid failed. He used his free hand to claw at Reacher's wrist. The wrong move. Unproductive. Always better to go straight to the source of the problem and use your free hand to hit the squeezer in the head or thumb out his eye or otherwise get his attention. But the kid didn't. A missed opportunity. Then Reacher added a twist to the squeeze, like turning a doorknob. The kid's elbow locked up and he dropped a shoulder to compensate, but Reacher kept on twisting. Until the kid got so lopsided he had to take his hand off Reacher's wrist and hold his whole arm straight out for balance. Reacher said, "Want me to hit you?" No reply. "It's not a difficult question," Reacher said. "A yes or no answer will do it." By that point, the kid was shuffling in place, trying to find a bearable position, huffing and gasping. But not squealing yet. He said, "Okay, sure. I got her signals wrong. I'm sorry, ma'am. I'll leave her alone now." "What about her job?" "I was kidding, man." "What about the next new waitress, down on her luck, in need of secure employment?" The kid didn't answer. Reacher clamped down harder and said, "Want me to hit you?" The kid said, "No." No means no, right? I expect they teach you that now. At your fancy university. Kind of theoretical, I guess, from your point of view. Until now. "Come on, man." "Want me to hit you?" "No." Reacher hit him in the face with a straight right, maximum force, crashing and twisting, like a freight train. The kid's lights went out immediately. He went slack and gravity took over. Reacher kept his left hand rock solid. All the kid's weight fell on his own locked elbow. Reacher waited. One of two things would happen. Either the strength and elasticity in the kid's ligaments would roll him forward, or they wouldn't. They didn't. The kid's elbow broke and his arm turned inside out. Reacher let him fall. He landed on the bricks outside the bag shop, one arm right and the other arm wrong, like a swastika. He was breathing, a little bubbly from the blood in his throat. His nose was badly busted. Cheekbones, too, maybe. Some of his teeth were out. Upper row, mostly. His dentist's kid was going to be just fine for college. Reacher walked away, back to his lodgings, up the winding stair and through the low door to his room, where he took a second shower and got back in bed, once again warm and damp. He punched the pillow into shape and went back to sleep. At which moment, Patty Sundstrom woke up. 3:15 in the morning. Once again, a pulse of subconscious disquiet had forced its way through to the surface. What were the flashlights for? Why two of them? Why not one? Or 12? The room was blissfully cool. She could smell the night air, rich, like velvet. Why pack 2 flashlights with 12 meals? Why pack them at all? What did flashlights have to do with food? They weren't natural partners. No one ever said, "Do you want a flashlight with that?" And what Shorty suggested was nonsense. No one ate lunch in the dark. Which was all it was. It was lunch for fellow rich guys up from Boston who wanted to feel rugged for a week. No one paying before Labor Day or leaf peeper rates would accept granola bars for dinner. Or breakfast. Lunch only, surely, as part of a manly outdoor fantasy. So why the flashlights? Lunch was eaten in the middle of the day. Generally speaking, the sun was out. Unless the rich guys were spelunkers. In which case they would have flashlights of their own, surely. Expensive specialist items, probably strapped to their heads. Why would flashlights be packed in a carton of food? As if they were somehow integral, like silverware or napkins would be. Were they packed? Maybe they were just shoved in there as afterthoughts. She kept her eyes closed and pictured the scene when they opened the box. She had slit the tape with her nail, and Shorty had lifted the flaps. What had been her impression? 2 flashlights in a box, standing on their ends, crammed in among the food. Crammed in. Therefore not packed as integral components. Added later. Why? 2 flashlights for 2 people. They had each been given a flashlight and 6 subsistence meals. Why? We put together some ingredients for you. Either join us at the house or help yourselves from the box. Which was kind of phony. Which they didn't mean. What else didn't they mean? She flipped the covers back and slid out of bed. She padded over to the dresser, where the carton sat in front of the TV screen. She lifted the flaps and felt inside. The first flashlight had fallen over in the void where the first 2 meals had been. She lifted it out. It was big and heavy. It felt cold and hard. She pressed it against her palm and switched it on. She rolled her palm a fraction and let a sliver of light spill out. It was pink from her skin. The flashlight was a famous make. It felt like it had been machined out of a solid billet of aerospace-grade aluminum. It had a cluster of tiny LED bulbs, like an insect's eye. She looked back in the box. The other flashlight was where it had started, rammed down into the crux between lunches 9, 10, 11, and 12. Some of the granola bars around it were cracked and splintered. One of the raisin boxes was crushed. Added later, for sure. She looked at the tape she had slit. 2 layers. One from the wholesaler, and one from them, when they resealed the box, after they added the flashlights. What else didn't they mean? She padded toward the door, and she nudged Shorty's bent shoe aside with her toe, and opened a gap wide enough to slip outside. She took her hand off the flashlight lens. It cast a bright white beam of light. She minced toward the Honda, with bare feet on the stones. She opened the passenger door. The hood release was where her shin would be. She'd seen it a million times. a broad black lever. She tugged on it. The hood sprang up an inch with a thunk that in the still of the night sounded like a wreck on the highway. She turned off the flashlight and waited. No one came. No windows in the house lit up. She turned the beam on again. She walked around to the front of the hood. She jiggled the catch and raised it up. She propped it with the bent metal rod that fit in the hole. She worked in a sawmill. She knew her way around machinery. She moved left and right and ducked her head until she could see what she wanted to see. The acid test. He knows what the problem is. He's seen it before. Apparently there's an electronic chip close to where the heater hoses go through the back of the dashboard. She leaned forward. She held the flashlight in her fingers, like a medical probe. She angled the beam, this way and that. Chapter 13 Patty Sundstrom identified the back of the dashboard easily enough. It was a bare panel, pressed and dimpled with strengthening reinforcements, gray and dirty, partially covered by a thin and peeling sheet of sound-deadening material. All kinds of wires and pipes and tubes went through it. Mostly electrical, she thought. The hot water for the heater would be in a thick hose, maybe an inch or so in diameter, serious and reinforced. By convention, black, she expected, clamped to a port on the engine block, which was where the hot water came from. And obviously it would be twinned with an identical black hose for the return feed. Circulation, around and around, because of the water pump, which stopped when the engine stopped, Peter said. She craned her neck and moved the flashlight beam. She found two black hoses connected to the engine block. There were no other candidates. She followed them with the flashlight beam. They stayed low in the bay. They passed through the bulkhead into the passenger compartment very low down, directly behind where the floor console was, with the gear shift lever. The heater was right above it. The heater hoses go through the back of the dashboard. No, they don't, Patty thought. She double-checked. They went nowhere near the back of the dashboard. They went through level with the bottom of the footwell, much lower down. And there was nothing near them anyway, just thick metal components, all caked with dirt. No wires. Nothing vulnerable. Nothing that would fry from excessive temperatures. Certainly no black boxes that might contain electronic chips. She backed away and straightened up. She looked at the house. All quiet. The barn was ghostly in the moonlight. All nine quad bikes were neatly parked. She killed the flashlight beam and minced back to the room. She stepped to the bed and nudged Shorty awake. He sat up in a panic and looked all around for passers-by or other intruders. He saw none. He said, "What?" She said, "The heater hoses don't go through the back of the dashboard." He said, "What?" again. "In the car," she said. "They go through real low down, about level with the bottom of the gear stick." "How do you know?" "I looked," she said, "with one of the flashlights they gave us."
"When?"
"Just now."
"Why?"
"I woke up. Something is not right."
"So you ripped the console out of the car?"
"No, I looked under the hood, from the other side. I could see the connection. And there's no electronic chip nearby."
"Okay, maybe the mechanic got it wrong," Shorty said. "Maybe he was thinking of a different year. Ours is a pretty early model. Or maybe Hondas are different in Canada.
Or maybe the mechanic doesn't exist. Maybe they never called one."
"Why wouldn't they?"
"Maybe they're keeping us here."
"What?
How else do you explain it?"
"Why would they?
Seriously?
You mean like an occupancy thing? Because of the bank? They want our $50?
"I don't know why.
hell of a way to do business. We could go on TripAdvisor. Except we can't go on anything. There's no Wi-Fi, and no cell signal, and no phone in the room.
They can't just keep people here against their will. Someone would miss them eventually.
We as good as told them no one knows we're gone.
We also as good as told them we're broke, Shorty said.
How long can they expect us to pay $50?
2 days, Patty said. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. 6 meals each.
That's crazy. Then what?
Then they call the mechanic?
We have to get out of here. We have to do the thing you said with the quad bike. So get dressed. We have to go.
Now?
This minute. It's the middle of the night. Like you said, they're asleep now. We have to do it now.
Because a mechanic was wrong on the phone.
If there was a mechanic at all. And because of everything.
Shorty said, why did they give us flashlights?
Patty said, I don't know that either.
It's like they knew we might want to leave in the dark.
How could they?
Shorty got out of bed. He said, we should take some food. Can't count on getting anywhere before lunchtime earliest. We'll miss breakfast for sure. They got dressed, hopping from foot to foot in the half-dark, with nothing but moonlight coming in the open door. They packed their stuff by feel and put their bags outside near the car.
You sure about this? Shorty said. Never too late to change your mind.
I want to go, Patty said. Something isn't right here. They walked down to the barn on the grass, not the dirt, because they felt it would be quieter. They were cautious across the last of the gravel, to the near corner of the perfect square of bikes, to the one Peter had driven away for Mark to use. Its engine was still faintly warm. Shorty wanted that exact one, because he had seen how to put its gearbox in neutral, and he knew it rolled along okay. But most of all, because it was closest. Who wanted to push extra yards? Not him. He clicked the lever to neutral and pushed back on the handlebars, kind of weak and sideways at first. But even so, the machine rolled back obediently, getting faster and faster as Shorty got more and more head-on in his pushing.
This is not too bad, he said.
He dragged the machine to a stop and took up a new position and pushed it forward again in a tight curve, a perfect, neat maneuver. Like reversing out of a parking space and turning and driving away. Patty joined in on the other side, and they pushed together and got up to a decent speed, steering along the center of the track toward the motel building, pretty much silently, apart from the scrape of their shoes on the dirt, and a lot of close-up squelching and popping from stones under the bike's soft rubber tires. They pushed on, breathing hard, around Room 12's corner, and onward to the Honda, 2 bays down, outside room 10. They stopped the bike right behind the car. Shorty popped the hatch.
Wait, Patty said.
She walked back to the corner and watched the house. No lights, no movement. She came back to the Honda and said, okay. Shorty turned to face the open hatch square on, and he bent forward with his arms spread wide, and he wriggled his fingers under the suitcase, both ends, and he heaved it up at the front and dragged it forward until it rested at an angle on the lip of the hatch. He grabbed the handle and hauled, intending to balance the case weightless on the lip, so he had time to change his position and adjust his grip, ready for the clean and jerk and the turn toward the bike. But the handle tore off the suitcase. Shorty tottered back a step. He said,
"Damn."
"Proves we couldn't have carried it anyway," Patty said. "That would have happened sooner or later."
"How are we going to get it on the bus?"
"We'll have to buy a rope. We could wrap it around a couple of times and make a new handle. So we need a gas station or a hardware store for the rope, first place we see." Shorty stepped forward again and bent down and got his fingers under the case. He grunted and lifted and gasped and turned and set it down on the bike lengthways, the top corners resting on the handlebar, the bottom edge digging into the padded seat. He nudged it a little and got it balanced. It ended up pretty solid, better than he thought it would. He was pleased overall,
He shut the Honda's hatch, and they strapped their overnight bags on the bike's rear rack. Then they took up position, Shorty on the left and Patty on the right, each of them with one hand clamped tight on the short length of handlebar visible either side beyond the suitcase's corners, and the other hand close to it, partly pushing, partly juggling a flashlight, which gave them twin makeshift headlight beams, and it made steering easy, and it meant they could steady the suitcase between them, with Shorty's right forearm and Patty's left at the top end, and with his right hip and her left at the bottom end, assuming they both walked kind of bent over at the waist, which clearly they would need to, because the weight of the load made pushing a whole different thing than before. Getting started required a full-on effort, both of them straining like a strongman show on cable television, and then keeping going afterward required nearly as much, although it got a little better when they bumped up out of the stony lot and onto the blacktop, at the very end of the road through the trees. More than 2 miles to go. They entered the tunnel. The air was cool, and it smelled of rotten leaves and damp earth. They gasped and trudged. Through trial and error, they learned it was best to keep their speed as high as they could bear, so that momentum alone would carry them through the long, shallow potholes. It meant a lot of effort all of the time, but it was better than starting over whenever the front wheels bumped down into a pit. They kept on going, almost running against the weight. Very quickly, no fun at all, just grinding it out. "I need to rest," Patty said. They let the bike coast to a stop. They nudged the suitcase left and right to perfect its balance. Then they stepped away and arched their backs and clamped their palms low down on their spines. They huffed and puffed and eased their necks. Shorty said, "How much further?" Patty looked back and then forward. "About 1.5 miles to go," she said. "How long have we taken so far? Maybe 20 minutes? Damn, that's slow. You said 4 hours. We're about on schedule." They took up their positions again and forced the thing to roll. Like a bobsled team at the top of the hill, going harder and harder with every step, they got it up to speed and kept it there, jamming their forearms against the trembling suitcase, ducking their heads, breathing deep, glancing up again to check their direction. They did another 1/2 mile and rested again. And another. A whole hour had gone by. "Coming back will be easier," Patty said. "Without the weight." They passed through the section where no trees grew. They saw a belt of sky full of stars. "Getting close," Patty said. Then she said, "Wait," and she hauled back on the handlebar and dug her heels in, way out in front, like a kid stopping a homemade cart. Shorty said, "What?" "There was a wire, like at the gas station, for ringing a bell, laying across the road. It probably rings in the house." Shorty hauled the bike to a dead stop. He remembered, as fat and rubbery as a garden hose. He searched ahead with his flashlight. They saw nothing. They rolled on half speed, which was a pain through the potholes, with one beam ranging far and the other sweeping close. 100 yards later, they saw it. Fat and rubbery and lying across the road. They stopped 4 feet short. Patty said, "How does it work?" "I guess inside there are 2 metal strips, somehow held apart. But when a wheel goes over, they get pressed together and a bell rings, like a push switch. So we can't let a wheel go over." "No." Which was a problem. Shorty couldn't lift the quad bike. Not at either end. Maybe 1 inch for a second, but not enough to ease it over the wire and set it down again. "How much further?" he said. "About 300 yards. I'll carry the suitcase." "Wait," she said again. She ducked down and eased her fingers under the fat rubber wire. She lifted it. It came up easily. 1 inch? 1 foot? As much as she wanted. She tested it side to side and pulled and tugged to make it equally loose. "Get ready," she said. She lifted it up gently on open palms, head high, arms wide. Shorty ducked low and pushed the bike under it. She held it until he was clear.
She felt like she was performing a dance ceremony at a hippie's wedding. Okay, Shorty said. She laid the wire back down gently, like she was bowing. Then they pushed on, energized. Safe, on the last lap, not far to go. Their flashlight beams bounced and swayed, first showing nothing but trees and the track between, but then a different kind of void loomed up ahead. The two-lane road, where they had turned in what felt like 1,000 years ago. Shorty had said, okay? Patty hadn't answered. Now, she said, we need to find a place to hide the suitcase, but not too far from the road, so we can load it easy when we get a ride. They let the bike slow to a stop where the mouth of the track widened out to meet the road. Hiding places looked to be in short supply. Tree trunks crowded in either side. The last yard of shoulder was thick with underbrush, although maybe a little thinner where the frost-heaved posts were set. Maybe the ground had been disturbed many years earlier. Maybe the brush was coming back slower. Maybe there was a suitcase-sized hole behind one or the other. Patty went to check. In the end, she figured the right-hand hole was better than the left. They huffed and puffed and got the bike as close as possible. Shorty spread his arms wide and lifted the suitcase off the bike, and then he grunted and gasped and turned and dropped it in the bushes, where it scraped and crackled through the lower branches and came to rest pretty well hidden. Patty walked up the road a spell and used her flashlight like an approaching headlight beam, and said she saw nothing much. Certainly nothing anyone would stop for. Just a dark shape, way low down, behind the base of the post. It could have been the corpse of a deer. She was satisfied. Then her voice changed, and she said, Shorty, come here. He went. They stood together on the county blacktop and looked back the way he had come, back along her flashlight beam, which was wavering on a wide area centered on the frost-heaved post, with the dark shape low and behind it, which you couldn't really see unless you knew it was there. He was satisfied, too. He said, what am I looking for? Think, Shorty, she said. What did we see when we turned in? He thought. He visualized. He took 2 sideways steps left, nearer the center line of the road, where the Honda's wheel had been. He squatted down a little, to approximate the level of the driver's seat. What had he seen? He had seen a frost-heaved post, on which was nailed a board, on which were screwed ornate plastic letters and an arrow pointing into the woods. The letters had spelled out the word motel. He compared his memory with the scene in front of him. He was pretty sure it was different. He stared. Then he saw. Now there was no board. No letters. No word. No arrow. Now there was just a post. Nothing on it. Same both sides of the track. Weird, he said. You think? So is it a motel or not? Sure feels like one to me. They're taking our money. We have to get out of here. We are. First car that comes. After we take the bike back to the barn. We don't owe them that, Shorty said. We don't owe them diddly. Not anymore. Not if they're pulling weird shit on us now, with the motel signs. We should dump the bike here and let them come get it themselves. They get up with the sun, Patty said. If there's a bike missing, they'll know right away. But if it's back in its proper place, they might not think about us for hours. They'll assume we're eating breakfast on our own, in our room. They'll have no reason to come by until later in the morning. It's a gamble. It could buy us a lot of time later. They'll come looking for us as soon as they find us gone. We need to delay that moment as long as possible. We need